Good afternoon and welcome to LSE Share Talk Conker's Corner. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Malcolm Pally, and Malcolm is the co-founder of Mining Maven. Good afternoon, Malcolm. How are you today?
I'm fine, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you, sir. Now, it's an absolute pleasure because I know that you guys are very, very active. It's a very active time for you guys, given the current state of market and lots of assets out there that are depressed in value. So it's very good of you to come on the call today.
Our pleasure. My absolute pleasure.
Okay, I'm going to start firstly, because as I said to you earlier, there's not a lot of information out there on Mr. Malcolm Pally. So could you bring us up to speed and give us a bit of background on your career thus far prior to becoming an investor, please, Malcolm?
Sure. Well, I mean, what I do now is a far cry from what I did when I left school, and I've done various different things. But my career started in the travel and leisure business. I started off as a tour guide. It was my first proper job. I worked in Europe. I worked in Eastern Europe, in Romania. It's a long story how I ended up there because I thought I was going to Ibiza. I know. In the last minute, the company found that they didn't need me in Ibiza, they needed me in Romania because it was I mean, you know, you tell a 23-year-old that he's not who's telling all his mates that he's going to Ibiza for the summer, and he ends up going to Romania. Anyway,
from, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, but it actually set me up really well because it was a weird place, but nonetheless, I picked up the language, learned a lot about the country, and started to do quite a bit of business out there, and set up a travel company which specialised in travel to Eastern Europe. Built that up into a tour operator, then set up an insurance company. Wow. A little bit later on after the wall came down in Romania, sold that to a Romanian company. And so my sort of career started there. I then moved into mobile comms, and I was one of the sort of pioneers of what we refer to as value-added services, which was basically when you used to get a mobile phone bill, it'll just be the bill. Yeah. But we found other things to sell to people, and I'm afraid if you get pestered by your mobile phone company to offer you insurance, that was my idea. So that sort of took me to about 2000, and then I had enough of that and sold out and moved up to Nottingham, bought a small hotel up here. Decided to run that for a couple of years. Then by the time 2002 came, I was turning into Basil Fawlty, and I decided that wasn't going to be for me. So I headed back down to London then, set up, well, what did I do? Yes, I was sort of really, that's when I started getting involved in small cap stocks because I had a bit of money and I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. I'd always invested in various, you know, I was often involved in placements and early stage IPOs, really for going back to the 80s. So I took it a bit more seriously, started getting involved then, learned a lot of lessons, lost a lot of money, and realized what I thought I know, I didn't. What I thought I knew, I didn't know as well learning, as I thought I did. And that was an expensive learning process. And I'd say there's that sort of really taught me one of the best maxims, which was that the market's only really there for two things. It's either to make you money or teach you a lesson.
Yes, very true.
And I found if you analyze that, you don't often learn much when you make money out of a stock.
Very true.
You get it right. You feel good about getting it right. You bank your profits if you're smart. But all the lessons come with losing.
Yes,
and
very true.
It's how you know, it's how you deal with that lesson or those lessons and how you incorporate them into your strategy going forward. And you have to be very careful how you learn, you know, how you apply those lessons, because, you know, it can very easily put you off investing forever if you lose too much in too much of a traumatic way. You know, if you still feel that, you know, you want to stay involved, you have to sort of distill those lessons down to actually what they really meant. And I've often found that it's more about my biggest mistakes have been when I've listened to other people to the point where I've actually thought they knew more than me or better than me.
Right. Okay.
Because I don't think there's, you know, it doesn't mean you don't listen to other people, but it's more important to actually think, what's my gut telling me?
Yeah.
You know, and that's always at the forefront. And anyway, so that's a whole subject in itself, I'm sure. No, so so that brought me into the back to effectively investing. Then I had the pleasure to, well, at the time, I don't know if it was a pleasure, I was at an AGM of a company that I was invested in, losing money, and I bumped into another chap who was in exactly the same position as me, and that was Paul Johnson. He was really berating the CEO of this company, and if I would have known then what I know now, I would have seen that was the best way, you know, the obvious thing for him to do.
Yeah.
But he was, as an accountant, he knew exactly what the company was doing wrong, and knew exactly how to express himself in terms of actually telling the guy what he should be doing and why he was annoyed with the company. And so I made a beeline for him afterwards, and I said, look, you know, what you said to this guy, I won't repeat the name of the company because I don't think they exist anymore. Yeah. But nonetheless, what he was saying was absolutely spot on. They just missed a trick. They missed a lot of tricks, and they were doing exactly what, well, they weren't doing what people wanted, and they weren't doing it themselves any favors either. I stayed in touch with him. We shared a bit of research. We were into some tech stocks then, and Paul was getting involved in the mining space, investing more and more. I had a really steep learning curve to go up to actually get myself up to speed on mining and exploration. And I did that because I saw the opportunities, and I did like gold. I was always sort of an investor in gold. And then the crash came in 2008, and both of us were looking around the space and thinking, you know, there's some real bargains out here.
Yeah.
When's this going to turn? We started positioning ourselves and looking at things, different stocks, only to realize that there wasn't really much going on in terms of commentary. A lot of the research wasn't covering the small situations. Even the research companies had really battened down the hatches because the whole city was in trauma.
Yes, so the end was nigh, wasn't it, then?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, who cared about a small mining company with a few thousand or million ounces worth of gold, of gold and in the ground? And, you know, they couldn't really do much with it. So these stocks were on their knees then. And it really was a matter of just them being literally in trauma. We started Mining Maven basically as a blog. And we both started writing about some of the companies we were invested in. Those companies approached us and said, you know, no one else is writing about us. Thank you very much. And you're doing a really good job. But the other thing was, we weren't writing as analysts. I wasn't really that. I mean, if I look back then to consider how much I knew about the space, and I was actually writing about it, is actually quite frightening. But I was looking at, I was looking at these companies as businesses, you see.
Yes, yeah.
And I understood them as businesses.
Yeah, that's really sometimes.
Yeah, and so from that approach, we started to relate to the people who are reading it, as in the investors, because they can understand business.
Yes.
It's just that when you look at mining companies and you hear all the technical terms and the geological terms, it can sometimes seem like a bit of a dark art.
Yeah.
But you know, you have to sort of go up the learning curve, and you have to be prepared to apply yourself to understanding some of it. And then it becomes a little bit easier. Because you'll see that I didn't ever imagined I'd be able to read or interpret or understand a drilling report. Yeah. And I can do that fairly well now. That's and brilliant. Everything becomes a little bit more sort of apparent. So, yeah, Mining Maven really started that way around. It's then Paul got, I was going to say distracted, but I don't think it's really a distraction, is it? He moved off into more corporate things and got involved with Metal Tiger. Started off with ECR, then Metal Tiger. I've continued with my investing and running Mining Maven as a facility.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it is really a very, we've got no ambitions of being a big brand, because you know, working with hundreds of companies, because I don't believe you can do hundreds of companies justice. I don't think there are hundreds of companies out there that are going to be the next big, you know, opportunity. Yeah. So I like Mining Maven, the idea of Mining Maven reflecting my investment ethos.
Yes.
And if we find a company that we or if I find a company, should I say it personally, that I want to invest in, or I am invested in, and it fits with the Mining Maven sort of strategy, then we'll work with them and talk about it. You know, it's that's really it. So I don't imagine we'll ever work with hundreds of companies. And I, you know, it's not that kind of a business. It's more, if you like, I was going to say a lifestyle business, but it is complementary to my investing. My investing is where I sort of that's what I live on.
No, I think what you started there was absolutely fantastic, Malcolm, because the problem is, and it still happens to this day, is that you read an RNS and you have to speak to about three or four other people before, I mean, to use your phrase, demystifying the terminology, the geologists or the CEOs or the CFOs, it's almost like they don't want people to understand the information they put on the RNS. So therefore, like Paul has said in the past, is that as an accountant, you have to read between the lines to actually see where the truth lies. And you shouldn't have to do that. Why shouldn't it be just in plain English?
Well, I think a lot of that is when it does come down to, you know, this sort of mysticism or dark art, or the technical terms. A lot of that is to do to regulatory
requirements. Right, okay.
Because you're starting in this place as with small caps, they're high risk. The from a regulatory point of view, you shouldn't be investing in these stocks unless you know what you're doing. But you won't get to know what you're doing until you, unless you're investing. So, you know, it really is a bit circular. Yes. And I agree with you. There should really be. There is always a way to put things across in plain English.
Plain English.
I think what you're seeing more and more of now, and you certainly didn't see this when I started investing, was the CEO's comments, you know, where they expand on the announcement and give their views. This really never used to happen. And it's something that sort of happened over the last few years, which gives, you know, investors an understanding of what the CEO or the MD thinks and feels. Yeah. And now it's pretty much standard. And it's up to, I suppose, other people are going to interpret it. You know, that's really what it is. Especially, you know, with mining, oil and gas, I think is a little bit more, it's even harder sometimes because, you know, there's a lot more going on, in those, you know, reports, but, you know, I'm not sure, we just live with it really.
Yeah. I don't think we have a choice until corporate governance gets, you know, gets a bit of a kick and
plain English
into the 21st century. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, Malcolm, we've covered some of the bases there on your background. I just wanted to touch on, you've gone back in the commentary there and you said you actually started investing back in the 80s.
Yeah.
So did you experience 1987 crash, lull, whatever you want to call it?
Experience is too light a word.
Oh, I'm sorry to touch on that nerve.
That's all right. No. Again, I said to you, the market's here for two things, to make you money or teach you a lesson.
Yes.
That was a massive lesson for me. Yeah, I was there. I was fully invested in the biggest load of crap, if I can say that, that you can imagine. Yeah. And I lost a lot of money. I lost almost everything then at the time. I was young enough to be able to bounce back. But that was the lesson where you're young and you think that runs go on forever. I had some Canadian stocks which a friend of mine was knocking out, and when the crash hit, I bought them at 20 pence. I can't remember what they were even now, but I bought them about 20 pence or 20 cents. They went up to $3 and I thought I was going to, you know, just piling in. And then the crash hit, they fell back down to, listen, the price was, the bid was 10 cents and the offer was $1.10.
Wow, that's some spread. It's
Well, they
crazy.
didn't want to do a trade. I mean, that was how I didn't realize they could do such a thing because
Ooh,
there's
I've
no
never heard.
market there. No.
Malcolm, I've never heard a spread like that, mate.
No, it was. I mean, this. Yeah, but there was a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of people were. They were jumping out of buildings, you know,
Yes,
in
they were. They
87.
were.
So, you know, these companies. I wasn't dealing with. I didn't know at the time, but I wasn't dealing with a legitimate broker. I
Oh.
was dealing with effectively a real bucket shop. I'm not talking about
Yeah,
the
bucket
sort
shop,
of
right.
the brokers that people refer to as bucket shops now. But
Yeah.
in those days, you know, it was the regulations. If they were there, they weren't enforced that strictly. But yeah, that was yeah, I was part. I suffered
Ooh
that
la
spell.
la. Wow. Let's move on swiftly then. After
Yeah.
after 87 then.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously we've touched on the fact that you're into NLP and you've had the time to reflect, had
Yeah.
87, you've got a little bit of money left, hopefully, of what's left of what you lost in 87, and you're
I had a
thinking,
credit card.
yeah, all right, okay. So what did you do after that then? After you tied your loose laces up and tightened your belt?
Well, that was when the mobile phone business was going, and
Right,
I was
okay.
running two things actually. I was in mobile comms,
Yeah.
and I was earning a lot of money selling mobile phones.
Yeah.
They were selling for about £2,000 each,
I remember,
and
yeah.
you know, there was good commission. I could make a couple of grand a week then,
Yeah.
and I threw all that into these stocks, you see. So
Yeah.
I had to just go back to work really, and take my work seriously. But that's when I started the mobile phone insurance and marketing business because I saw that was a real opportunity. I stayed clear of the stock market throughout the 90s,
Right, okay.
until, well, I did dabble about in the tech boom towards the end of the 90s because I couldn't resist it. It was, but I didn't get, fortunately, I didn't get myself too exposed then.
Right, okay. Because it was all the rage. If you weren't in tech, you weren't in anything, weren't you, in the
That's
90s?
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely happening, and the .com was happening, and I saw that. There was no question that that was, I could see the difference it was making, and that bubble was unbelievable. I was in some presentations with some companies who were raising money literally. I mean, they were saying on the back of a cigarette pack, but you know, it was just a couple of pages,
Yeah,
and if it was a
idea, words, and
it
that's
was an
it. Yeah.
idea, yeah, they'd raise the money. You know, since then, I mean, you know, that was what I was doing in the 90s. Yeah, it was sort of a fun time, but you know, I didn't really get too drawn into the tech boom then, and that was when, you know, after that I just moved on and bought this hotel. I mean, I bought it because it was with a friend of mine. You know, it looked
Yeah.
like a good development to actually convert into flats.
Yeah.
Then when I saw, you know, the figures. I mean, it wasn't a huge business, but I could thought, well, you know, I've had enough of what I was doing. I'd been doing the same thing for 11 years with the
Yeah.
mobile phone marketing business, and I thought, let's try running a little hotel and have, you know, taking it easy. I mean, but it just wasn't. It
Yeah, you
wasn't an
thought it was
easy
going to be more leisurely.
one. Yeah, well, we ended up. You know, you think you got this idea about what it is. You tell people you run a hotel or you own a hotel, and people have their own idea of what that is. Well, in reality, we are. Clients were apprentice mechanics from all over the country that worked at Vauxhall,
Wow.
and they were coming in. They were 16, 17 years old, getting drunk every night, throwing up, and God knows what, and all the other. And so we had to, you know, we had to feed them. They went up
Yeah.
during the day to do their courses, but in the evening they were causing hell.
Yeah.
So you know, but it was good money. But you know,
But
that
not
was
leisurely at all.
not at all, no.
Oh dear, oh dear. So I'm trying to get a blend here of
Right.
what sort of investor you are, Malcolm. You seem
Hard
to,
to say, isn't it? Yeah.
yeah, tech,
Okay. Well, I'll
mining.
look. Okay. Well, let mining is what I know now.
You're a
Mining
value
is.
investor, aren't you, essentially? You like value.
Yes, but
Yes.
I've got a pretty healthy risk appetite,
Yeah.
if that makes sense.
No, I understand that.
Yeah. What I tend to do is I look at things from the point of view of the upside.
Yeah.
I see if I can get the right entry point, and I'm prepared to, you know, what I'm prepared to put on the table is what I'm prepared to lose.
Yeah.
And that can pile up, that can actually sort of grow to an extent, you know, even if I was to look at it with in the cold light today and say, well, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I try to get a good understanding of the downside as well. Yeah. And what I particularly like about in the mining space, it's not because I, you know, particularly like mining. I like gold, but I like the cyclical nature of it.
Yes.
Because anything to do with cycles is predictable, much more predictable than anything else. You can rely on those cycles, not necessarily the timing of them, but you can rely on the you know, the way they run, and the pattern. So if I, after 4 years of a downturn, which we've had in the mining space, you know that there's an upswing coming. You don't necessarily know when it's going to be, but you know there's one coming, and you know when it comes that it's going to have a certain pattern to it, which has been repeated and repeated. And you know, some of the stocks that I'm positioning myself in now have similarities to, or are in some cases the same stocks as I was investing in 2009, 2010, and it's really. And the environment is the same. I'm seeing the same kind of people on forums criticizing these companies and these stocks for the same kind of issues. And it's a real distraction. I mean, it's great to see, because from my point of view, it says to me, this is great. We're coming out of that cycle, that down cycle. It reconfirms the upswing for me when I see this noise, if you like.
Yeah, noise, exactly.
I mean, I'm not I'm not trying to be disparaging to people who have lost money. The fact of the matter is, everything's about timing.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're actually positioned at the right time in the right space, then you can let the cycle take care of itself.
No, that's a fantastic analogy there. I think what's happened, unfortunately, is that there are so many companies that oil, let's just call it one, resource companies.
Yeah.
A lot of them have got indebted. A lot of them have got assets sitting there, and banks and other entities that were supporting them have got themselves in a bit of a pickle and have said, we're no longer supporting you. So these companies, like you say, back in 2010, are back where they are again in 2016, and again looking for help. To get back to where they should be. And the assets are sitting there, and it's only the likes of yourself and other people that are looking more long term and thinking, you know what, here's the opportunity again. I can come in and I can start building a slow position over the next 3 or 4 years, and then eureka, it's on its way potentially.
Yeah, I mean, the support for the small cap space has not traditionally come from the banks. It's usually this community of brokers or high net worth
individuals.
Whoever they are, who are used to playing these games. I say these games because it is basically the mining space is very much like gambling. You just have to pick the right guys to back. Now, they could be the lucky guys, they could be the good guys, whoever they are, the ones who have got the track records, you tend to sort of follow. And occasionally you'll get some new kids on the block who are actually doing great stuff and are showing a new way of doing things. Without mentioning too many names, you can see this happening in our orbit a lot. And people reinventing, you know, the approach. But yes, in essence, you're right. It has been. It is that time in the cycle where there's some stranded assets, and a lot of the companies in the space are, you know, they're out shopping, they're looking at things, they're being offered stuff, because ultimately the heroes in the upturn are now, you know, the zeros now. A lot of them have got to get these assets off their books. Even the large companies have got to do that. But we've come to the end of the first, very early part of the first phase, which was the recognition that you can actually start to be able to raise money to do things, very speculative money. And now, you know, that these companies are sort of positioning themselves to go shopping, buying some of the distressed assets, or even, you know, restarting their exploration programs. It's just starting off. And it won't be, you know, it's not going to be a smooth ride up, but it will start to grind up. There'll be some pullbacks along the way. You know, I think, you know, the best lesson at this stage is not to overextend yourself, you know, not to go piling in at the first, you know, the first signs of the recovery, because there's plenty of time. Yeah. There's plenty to come, and there'll be plenty of opportunities. And likewise, it's, you know, it's probably a little bit early to take too much off the table, because there's a lot more meat left in the, you know, on the bone.
No, that's, I think you've covered it there. The essential thing is to have patience, Malcolm, which is what you're touching on, and a sense of not going all in now. Find your watch list, monitor the stocks, look at the management, look at the directors, look at what they've done before, and spread, you know, diversify. Does that cover it, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when you say meet management, very important. We run events at Mining Maven, and they're often very informal. And I remember when I first started in the space, I was a little bit intimidated to go and talk to a company manager. I wasn't sort of shy as such, but because it was such, in my mind at the time, a technical subject, I didn't want to come across as an idiot. But you find out that the people who ask the stupid questions are the people who get the best answers.
Very true.
You know, you can't really, it's your money at stake. They want your money.
Yeah.
And this is the real point. And if you, if you've had a bit of experience in life, irrespective of you know, what you do, and you can look someone in the eye and sort of have a fair chance of being able to find out whether they're, you know, a straight talker, then that's a tremendous attribute and tremendous skill, because you'll need that. And you should really be making a point of meeting the management of some of these companies in any space. You know, you can see someone and sum them up, judge them, and see what you think of them. Because if something doesn't sit well with you when you're actually talking to someone or listening to what they say, then that's a warning sign.
Exactly.
Now, it might not be the same for everyone. It just might be for you. Do you know what I mean? I mean, not all stocks are for all people. And so, I found that it's always good to actually meet with management, and you know, don't be in awe of these people. They want your money. You know, and their proposition, their pitch to you has got to stack up for you to actually hand it over. Whether it be in a placing or whether it be on the market, however it is, if you're going to back them, you've got to trust that, to the extent you can trust them, because you never trust anyone 100%. You want to make sure as well, when you're doing your research, that the interests of investors are aligned as much as they can be with the interests of management as well. That's important.
That's very important. Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah.
Now, I'm looking here and I'm thinking, I've got this question lined up. I'm not sure if it applies to you, because obviously you are essentially a deep forensic sort of researcher. So I'm going to plow on anyway. When you're researching your companies, Malcolm, to make your personal investments, what are the criteria, the ultimate criteria that push you to make a purchase?
Right. Okay. There's never one specific area. It could be, I suppose, there could be lots of different there could be lots of different criteria. But I'm not exactly a forensic researcher. I'm a thorough researcher.
Thorough researcher, okay.
You know, I mean, in my mind, there's a difference. And that's because I'm not the greatest with numbers, but I just want to look at this as a business. I want to make sure that, you know, as much as possible I've covered the areas that I know. I think that I'm looking at the price, the value, the amount of shares that are out there, the market cap, and what's down the line, what is potentially down the line. I think that's really the point. And if I, you know, if I can quote some examples, I don't know if that's the right thing to do in this format, but, you know, if I'm looking at a mining company or an exploration company that's about to go into production, I want to envisage what that situation is going to look 6 months down the line, 3 months down the line, a year down the line, and see where the risks are inherent in that process. In this stage in the cycle, it's a little bit different because you have got so many potential catalysts that could happen very quickly. And one, for instance, in this space is the price of gold. I'm positioning myself with certain stocks that I've got a core position in.
Yeah.
And then I've got some speculative money, which is sort of running around between some stocks that have got some potential catalysts that might happen in the next 3 months. But if I see gold as maybe the next move is through 1300, then I want to say, okay, what are the stocks that are going to be affected best by a move in gold through 1300?
Yeah.
Now, in the mining stocks, it would be the high cost producers, because the higher the price of gold goes, the nearer to
positive production. Yeah,
exactly. They get, and so they have the biggest impact. Yes. I must admit, I do avoid some of the larger miners, so I don't actually look at too many of those high cost situations. But it's not straightforward, I'm afraid. I don't know if that's
no, that's fine, because what I was going to say to you, I didn't want to interrupt you, Malcolm, was the fact that you obviously like your tech stocks, you like your mining stocks, so I would appreciate that, depending on which sector you're actually choosing to buy, make a purchase, there may be speculative, there might be core holdings that you want to invest in, and if it's in tech or insurance or in mining, you're going to have a slightly different criteria for each sector.
Yeah. Now, tech is interesting, because what I haven't mentioned is I was involved in founding a company called Coincilium, which is a Bitcoin blockchain related company. I don't know if you know much about Bitcoin.
I know about Consilium. I was going to get onto that later on, chat.
Oh, really? Okay. I'll leave that to you if you found that out. That's
I've done
great.
I've done my research, mate. I've got to you have some questions.
You? Good for you.
We'll get onto Consilium in a little while. Okay. Definitely. Most definitely. So, so different criteria for different sectors. Whilst we're on it, just run with Consilium and tell people what's been happening there and what your plans are for that company, please, Malcolm.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm no longer a director of the company. I'm an investor in it as much as anyone else is. I did found it. I was a founder. Yeah. Basically, I had a fascination with Bitcoin when it came about. And when I saw the price going crazy in 2012, I think 2013, I wondered what the hell this was all about. I couldn't find anyone to tell me too much about it or explain it in ways that I understood. Yeah. Then I ran into an accountant at a party. I mean, that's the
another
kind of
one.
Person. No, I was going to say, you usually try and avoid accountants and insurance salesmen at parties, but I had him pinned up against the wall and I wouldn't let him go. He was happy, because people don't usually do that with accountants, do they? But someone will talk to him. Fantastic. And he managed to explain in a nutshell what Bitcoin was. And it's really about the technology that enables Bitcoin. And it's without going into too much elaborate detail, it's basically a distributed ledger, which enables everyone to see every transaction that's occurring at any one time without anyone in control. What you can do with that ledger is what's interesting. So what I effectively did, I followed it. I spent about 6 months researching it. And then I realized that, you know, there's something in this technology which is big. And it wasn't my idea. You know, it wasn't the revelation I came to on my own. I could see that what certain people in the space were saying and doing meant this was the case. And Bitcoin had the ability to act like money, which was weird, because it was the first thing that had come along probably since money that was like money, but acted like money, you know, but wasn't money, but acted like money.
With greater transparency as well. Yes,
completely. It was a way. The parallels with gold were great, were really made sense to me. And so I thought, well, all these things that people need to make this system work, this blockchain system work, are going to need to be built out. And the most fascinating thing for me at the time was when I realized that the people developing companies and businesses in this space, you need money to create these businesses. These guys weren't using money, they were using Bitcoin. So if you had made, you bought some Bitcoin for, or some people got them for nothing when they first started mining them.
I mean,
that's another aspect about mining Bitcoin. Let's not go into that, because that will sort of fry your brain. Yeah, but Bitcoin is mined by computers. So people effectively had this Bitcoin on their computer. They mined them. They went up from nothing to $1,200 a Bitcoin at one time. People were selling them, living on them, and there was a whole parallel economy running through this space. I mean, it was the first proof of concept was, you know, the fact that it worked for criminals, because there was a lot of people, criminals using it, which I, from a lot of people try to shy away from that as a, and think that that's a bit dodgy. But in any technology, criminals are usually the first people to actually test a technology.
Yes.
And if it works, because they need to be really careful. They need things to be work for them more than we do as honest people. And when I was selling mobile phones, some of the earliest customers were ladies of the night, because it made their life a lot easier, drug dealers and all sorts of other people, which, you know, you had to run the gauntlet because you really wouldn't want to necessarily go and sell to a lot of these people. But that was a predominant area, a new technology. Is it? And likewise with the internet, you know, how fraud and whatever, you know, so that whole idea of criminals getting involved is more of a, about proving that the technology works than actually anything else. But so I realized that these guys were building wallets, because you need a wallet to use Bitcoin, exchanges. There were various other kinds of services run through Bitcoin, gambling, gaming, and various other payments, marketplaces. And these guys were building these things without going to anyone outside of the Bitcoin ecosystem for money. They were getting they were being paid in Bitcoin. So a whole industry grew up overnight, over a few years, should we say, using Bitcoin to actually fund itself. So I sort of looked at it and said, well, let's see how we can get some real money into this space and see what's required for that. Because some of these things are really neat ideas. And, you know, once you start seeing what it can offer in terms of the technology. So I identified a couple of guys who were running an incubator for Bitcoin companies and blockchain companies. Well, it was mostly Bitcoin then. And I met up with them, and we sort of developed a line of conversation whereby I thought that if I could introduce them to the right people, we could work towards getting this business listed in London. And effectively, that's what I did. I introduced these two guys to Cameron Parry, who was at the time the CEO of Metal Tiger, who I knew. And the four of us founded Coincilium. We did have the intention initially of aiming of listing on AIM. For a variety of reasons, unfortunately, that didn't happen. And it's now on the ISDX market, which is actively, you know, it's an active market, although the liquidity there at the moment isn't great. But it has got a listing. It's got it's now set up on itself. Cameron's no longer involved in the management. I've stepped back from the management as well. And it's sort of, you know, it's set on its own. It's got a good CEO who's very embedded in the space, Eddie Travier. New chairman, Laurent Cassis, has got a corporate finance background. He's pretty well connected, and he understands the space. And their chief technology officer is a guy called Hakim Mamoni, who was, you know, one of the original guys with Eddie, myself, and Cameron. And he's you know, he's one of these guys who's got a computer for a brain, you know. I mean,
yeah,
he's
it's good
really
to have one of those around.
Yeah, no, no, he's a computer scientist, basically. He gets the space and he's been involved in it. So they're one of the few, in fact, I think they're the only investing company that's listed on any market that is in this space. It is a long haul. It's going to be, you know, it's not one of those like mining companies or oil and gas companies. You put a few drill holes down, you come up with the stuff you need, and you take it to, you know, you sell it and take it to the bank. You can't do it. It's not a quick turn. But this this sector is set to transform a lot of different businesses. So what they're building there and what they're doing is interesting. One of their investee companies, for instance, is a company called Satoshi Pay, and they enable micropayments. And they've just done a deal with Visa.
Yes, so, I've seen that. I saw that deal. I've seen it. I was like, Visa. And I was like, who are these guys?
I know.
To get that deal with Visa, Malcolm, that is staggering.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, I'm a little bit blasé about it because I can see,
you should
I can
be.
See, Well, it's I could see it happening. I could see what would need, you know, I could see the synergies between the two, because you can't use your Visa card to buy something for 10 pence because the charges are too high. And I was actually, before I actually knew that they'd done the deal, I was at a presentation that Visa were doing, and I asked, it's Visa Europe, I'd asked the guy presenting a question in all innocence, and I said, what do you think of micropayments? You know, you can't buy anything for less than a quid or 60, 70 pence, certainly is about the threshold on a credit card. Yeah. Do you look at micropayments as an irrelevance? Because it's not so much, you know, going into a shop and using your card to buy something for a small amount of money. It's more about online content.
Yes.
You know, businesses like publishers, what are they going to do? You know, at the moment, they're relying on advertising, which is, you know, it's a very fast moving space. Pop-ups are not particularly palatable. They don't work on mobile phones. This technology, which has been embraced by Visa with a deal with Satoshi Pay, means that you could buy an article online for 5 pence or 4 pence.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about it is it's a two-way platform. So you could get paid to actually watch a video, or you could get paid for filling in a survey.
This
is money that you can actually use and, you know, accumulate and cash out. You can get people working in parts of the world where maybe, you know, the wages aren't as high as they are here, and make themselves a couple of dollars when they come back from school for doing something that is a legitimate, you know, enterprise. So there's lots of uses for this. And you don't need a bank account for this. This is the other thing.
Yes.
You can just have it in your wallet and you can spend it. So it's and your Bitcoin wallet is just an app on your phone.
No, that's absolutely. I mean, there's a thing to be said, mate, in the sense of, you know, I'll refer back to Bernard Baruch, the famous financier and statesman back in 1870, right, to 1965. Become humble as the market goes your way. Now, that's exactly what you've done there, Malcolm. You've got Consilium flying high. You've got it listed. You've got Satoshi Pay, one of their investee companies, getting a deal with a Visa. And you're going, yeah, I was a bit blasé about that, Pete. I'm like, what? It's not very often that Visa come knocking on your door, Malcolm.
Yeah, well, it wasn't our door, to be fair. It was the investee. And I didn't do a whole heap other than say, I think this will be a good idea.
Yeah.
And it's great to get it right.
Yes.
But likewise, so I'm sort of saying, well, I'm certainly not going to take credit for it myself. But on the same token, I think it's when I say blasé, I'm a bit more. Yeah, what took you? Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
it's just an obvious. It's an obvious thing, and there are a lot of things in this space. And it's like, I mean, you know, come back to mining. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
I bought. I mean, I'll mention that I bought Red Rock Resources in 2010, I was buying it in 2009 for under a quarter of a penny, and I was looking at what they had and what I knew they had at the time, and I'm thinking this is a no-brainer.
Yeah,
and sure enough, you know, after a couple of years, the price was 16 pence and it went up to 20. But you needed a lot of other things to happen.
Yes.
To make it make sense. Yeah. You know, the gold price needed to go up, which it did. A few other things. And, you know, your ducks, like the stars align and everything goes great. So, but you don't get those opportunities unless you get in them at the earlier stage.
Yeah. And I think, go on.
I was going to say, and obviously you don't go in, you know, you don't bet the house on it.
Yeah.
You know, that's key. And, you know, psychologically as well with investing, I don't like to go more than I can afford to lose. As I said, even though I've got quite a healthy risk appetite, because it changes the way you think. It's not about if you lose it all. Mm-hmm. You become emotionally attached.
Yes.
And I've often had this conversation with people. If I start thinking I like this stock too much, or I like, you know, I really am excited about where it's going, the natural thing might be, so I've got to buy more. That's the point I sell some.
Right. Okay. I was going to touch on your strategy. You can do that
that's
now
just
if you like.
Teach me a lesson.
Yeah.
To give myself a slap for getting too excited.
Well, that's fair enough. I think there has to be an element of de-risking in every strategy to make you know, for long term, so you've got a portfolio and a pot there to actually play with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So so there you go. As far as strategy is concerned, is there any specific questions you have on that?
Yeah, I was going to ask you really about the fact. I think you touched on it before. You're scaling, and I'm getting the impression you scale out. However, not to touch on it too raw, is in the 87 period where you had the Canadian ones. It went all the way up there. You had a 20-30 bagger. How much did you actually take out before actually the crash?
I didn't have a strategy then.
Ah, right. There
you My go. Strategy was I've got all these shares. They're going to go up forever. Yeah. And I've got a date with a beautiful girl, and I'm driving a very nice car. Now leave me alone. Just, you know, let the shares get on with doing what they need to do, and they owe me a living. You know, I didn't. The only lesson I learned out of that was the crash taught me the lessons I needed to know. Before then, I had no strategy.
Right. Okay. And now you've got a portfolio of investments. You've got a fantastic website in Mining Maven, and you're still looking for opportunities now at the bottom of the cycle. You've got a strategy that covers tech, mining, insurance. You know, you've run the whole gamut.
Well, sort of. Yeah, I'll. I mean, from an investing point of view, I will look at tech.
Yeah.
And I'll market stuff. I don't have a whole heap of investments. I think with tech, it's a cyclical thing. It's not the greatest place to be in from a cyclical point of view. Although there's no natural reason why tech stocks should be cyclical. They sometimes are. Yeah. I think it's more to do with the scarcity of the funds. You know, if they're going to go into another space, then they get drawn out of tech by virtue of the fact that the other space is more attractive. So my predominant the mainstay of my portfolio predominantly is mining and exploration. It's small cap, it's high risk. None of it is sort of revenue generating miners. I have been in and out of them, but it's mostly, you know, the companies we look at are Mining Maven, Metal Tiger, Ariana Resources, Goldstone, Greatland, you know, just a portfolio, BMR. You know, companies that you've got, I can get my arms around in terms of understanding what they're going to do. So, you know, they'll always be able to surprise you to the upside and the down. But I think that I'm not going to get a surprise that perhaps I should have known about, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, you're looking for the catalyst going forward, and you've already assessed the downside.
Yeah. I mean, as far as Mining Maven's concerned, I just want it to be, you know, this is going to be a conduit to help us and investors as well, so that I can do the interviews with the companies and when they have news. And it supports my investing, and it also helps with the general promotion of the sector and space. And we put on events pretty much. They've just started again. They're about every couple of months where we get companies down to talk to people. And, you know, that's pretty enjoyable. As long as it's fun, I like doing it, you know. And I say it's fun. You know, it's work as well, but it's not, I don't, you know, it's intense, but it's not stressful.
You've got to enjoy it. Now, we spoke earlier, I know you've got an interest similar to myself in NLP. So I'm going to recommend this book, Malcolm. You know, it's a beautiful book. It's just recently been written. Is the author's called Catherine Stott, and the book's called Hypno Trading, a practical guide to using hypnosis and NLP to improve your trading performance. Now, this book is, you know what, I saw this lady at the Master Investor Show, and I spoke to her, and I said, is this your book? I said, yeah, and I spoke to her at length, and I've got a love for NLP anyway.
Yeah.
I use a bit of mindfulness in my trading as well.
Uh-huh.
But the fact she's put this together in a book to cover all this, you know, because psychology in trading, people don't really get it. Of the importance of keeping your emotions together and not becoming too arrogant and having egos and all the rest of it.
Right.
But she works with traders in the city to help them with their emotions, so they iron out their mistakes and their flaws. And it's an absolutely fascinating book. So if you can get hold of a copy, I would recommend it, mate.
I will. I'll have a look at that. I mean, I do think that psychology is so important. I mean, I've not really delved too far into NLP, but I know what it's all about. And I know that, you know, the mind works in a way that we don't often can't get our heads around.
We don't
often think about it. We just do so many things naturally. And these patterns, good patterns of behavior, good habits can be built. And, you know, I think that it's more about, you know, you you can learn pretty much everything if you've got everything in place to actually those building blocks in place for you to learn them. And a discipline is so important. We actually, early on, I'm thinking of republishing it. We wrote a piece called The Reptilian Always Wins for investors. And basically, it's based on the work of a guy called Clotier Rappel, who French chap, professor, worked with autistic children.
Right,
and he actually then applied his lessons to marketing. He's written a book called The Culture Code. And it's basically, I mean, I've got it in front of me. I keep it handy. It's an ingenious way to understand why people around the world live and buy as they do.
Yes.
So what he actually explains in that is about how culturally in different places people think in different ways.
Indeed.
And our points of reference can be so can influence the way we actually behave. So this piece we wrote was about the flight and fear, the fear and greed mechanism that markets work on. If you can actually find the right way of actually reversing the polarity of that and go where you should be fearful of going. And it's a little bit like, I think it was Sir John Goldsmith said, buy when there's blood on the streets. And it's about that whole psychology of actually keeping your emotions in check and making sure that when you actually where the greatest fear is where the greatest opportunities are. So I've used a lot of that.
No, that's absolutely spot on, mate. Now, I wanted to ask you this question because I know that you're you like to look at different opportunities and where things lie, and you're always looking one step ahead of the herd, as we say. If there was one thing you could change, Malcolm, in the investing landscape, given the way it is now, what would that be?
You mean as it applies to me, or
as it applies to as applies to you, as it applies to being an investor? I mean, obviously, you've got your interest in Bitcoin with Consilium and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And there's fractions of pennies being thrown around the stock market every single day. So that might be an opportunity for Consilium. I don't know, but
there is. I mean, it's about the shares trading in. That would be about shares trading on the blockchain, which would be transparent, which would be fantastic. I think, well, there's lots of things I'd change, Peter. There's lots of things, but the first thing that was actually, I'll start with the positive, is actually happening now, is social media. Social media is exposing a lot of the shortcomings in the market. It's exposing a lot of the people who have really just being paid fees for doing things that aren't really effective, but they're the only place to go. So what's happened is that investors, and this is sort of comes down to, I think they call the wisdom of the crowd, is maturing, it's evolving, and you're getting some really smart decisions being made, which are ahead of the institutions in the city, which I know that some people use the term AIM casino as a derogatory term.
Yes, they do,
I don't think it's a derogatory term. I think that's what it is. It just happens to be a casino where the house has held the advantage for so long, but now the way things are being transparent, they've always tried to keep control over the herd, because that would be their vulnerability. So if the herd comes along and buys into a stock, they can't control that. It's basically social media is evening the balance. It's allowing people to discuss propositions with themselves, find out far quicker if there's anything wrong, find out much quicker if there's something good that they should be going for. And the likes of PR companies are not really effective, and they haven't been effective for a long time when it comes to actually, people like Alex, who goes out, sticks a microphone in front of someone, does an interview with them. And yes. No one, the amount of people that listen to it is fantastic. Yeah. I'm doing the same in my own, perhaps a little bit more, I won't say technical, but, you know, it's more in depth and it's more company specific. But, you know, it's slightly different, but it's another flavor. Same kind of thing. There are discussions that are going off, thank goodness, off of bulletin boards now.
Yes.
Because bulletin boards in general, and there's one exception which I want to make a point of, and that's BlueShare. And I haven't looked into it too far, but I think these guys are doing a great job because the main forums have really got to get their, dinosaurs. They're dinosaurs.
Act together, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably too late because I don't think they're going to. I mean, LSE, to be fair, a little bit more progressive than ADVFN. There's a maxim which I use, which is if a service is free, then you're the product.
Right. That's a great analogy, actually.
Like Isn't it?
Yeah.
Because ultimately, you know, the bulletin boards there are not fit for purpose in general, but people can use Twitter and they're using it now.
Yes, they
and
are.
They're informing themselves and they're communicating with each other. And I think this is going to drive a lot of change in the way things work. If I take myself back to when I first started investing after I sold my hotel, which was 2003-04, I was in tech stocks then. The CEO of one tech stock I was invested in wanted to meet with investors, and I'd started a network on a bulletin board, and we were sort of discussing things off the forum. And he said, "Can you bring these guys in so we can? I want to talk to you because I don't, you know, I can't put an RNS on this because it doesn't meet that requirements, but I want to give my overall strategy." So basically, it was like one of the investor presentations you see today that he wanted to do. This was before the likes of Proactive existed.
Yeah.
His nomads wouldn't let him do it because they said you can't speak to investors without, you know, it's fraught. In the end, he managed to persuade them to. He had a room in one. It was the boardroom actually in their office. His nomad insisted that he recorded the whole event.
Yeah.
So that to back him up just in case he got into trouble. There was this enormous fear of for companies speaking directly to investors who weren't pre-qualified.
So the scale of litigation, basically.
Whatever it was regulation, probably, I think, more.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it just didn't happen. The companies didn't speak. They spoke to, you know, they spoke in the city. They did these lunches with brokers and with certain high net worths who they knew were in their orbit
circle.
and in their circle. But now it's evolving. This, you know, we've already have the investor presentations where pretty much anyone who's all you need is the money and you can turn up, or you don't even need that, but you know what I mean. Suits anyone can invest. It's more democratized. Social media has just added that flavor where you've got activity pretty much 24/7, and you've got a whole wealth of breadth of ways where people can engage, investors can engage. So that democratization process has matured to the point, I think the next shoe to drop has got to be a change in the way that this whole market's regulated, the function of the FCA. It's completely antiquated. They're faceless. They, you know, things happen on AIM and they don't deal with it. They're under-resourced. And I think this market will probably police itself better if left to its own resources. But, you know, that's by the by, because they get exposed by all sorts of people when they're doing naughty stuff.
I think that the element of corporate governance is in for, like you say, a big, big change. And I'm not sure if it's going to be a case of shareholder groups grouping together and attending AGMs or seeking redress for the lack of corporate governance, especially. The big issue now, obviously, is remunerations of some of the larger companies whose CEOs and CFOs are getting staggering amounts of money year in, year out, regardless of performance. So there is a big sea change. And I'm speaking with Mark Bentley of ShareSog shortly on Conker's Call to just give his investing journey a bit of a listen to, but also for him to talk about the organisation and their role for shareholders' rights. So we're trying to do our best with in that regard.
Yeah, I think corporate governance is, you know, it's a whole area, isn't it? But yeah. When you come down to, let's face it, if a director or a board is getting away with paying itself a disproportionate amount, I think there's nothing wrong with high salaries if they are, you know, justified. How do you justify it? Well, of course, you're creating shareholder value. But, you know, that's the one way to justify it. And then even then, you need a remuneration committee to agree it. Yeah. But quite often, they just fly in the face of whatever investors think. And I think that whole process is probably going to change. And that, again, will be brought about by the growth in investor activism through which has been facilitated by social media. Because that's really what it is.
Well, that's exactly why Alex and the team here at LSE Share Talk are pushing this, you know, this vehicle of LSE Share Talk with regards to marketing and PR companies, because there are lots of companies overlooked. There's lots of information not disseminated down to shareholders. And Alex, through his wisdom, just started just hitting every single company that he possibly could, like you say, with a mic. And we did the same at Master Investor. Just people that didn't expect to be interviewed were interviewed, you know. So it's great to get them on the website and to get Q&As with companies. You know, these are questions directly from people that are interested and also individuals that are currently shareholders. So we will plough on and hopefully we'll do some joint working with you as well at Mindhaven on individual stocks as well.
Very happy to do that. I saw everything that the way Alex works is a live wire. It's got a tremendous amount of energy. And again, you know, he's asking people questions that investors will ask.
Exactly.
And that's important. No, it's a great thing to see the way it's grown in such a sort of a very, very short space of time. Yeah, yeah. So he's obviously hit the spot there, and good luck to him. Hope he's got the energy to keep it going.
Yes, well, we're trying to share the workload, hence I'm doing this, and Simon and Rob are putting their bits and pieces in
right.
as well.
Okay. And well, any help, support, whatever, let's talk, because, you know, we've got a wealth of resource here. You know, it's only me really that runs it, and I'm happy with that. But on the same token, if we can cooperate with you in any way, Alex is full of ideas as well.
Yes,
so, you know, let's talk about it.
Excellent. Now, Malcolm, I've got one more question, and then we can talk about some of the things if you like. I'm conscious that I've kept you on the line for nearly an hour.
I'm fine with it. I'm just worried about boring listeners to tears.
No. I think they're fine. I think they've learned quite a lot from you and given your vast experience. Now, given you've been in the market now for Neon 30 years almost, I'm not going to try and give your age away or anything like that.
Why not? I'll tell you how old I am.
If you were starting out today,
30 years.
If you were starting out today in investing, what would you do that you'd not considered or were unable to do back in the 80s when you first started investing?
What, with the benefit of all the knowledge I have now?
Yes, indeed.
God, right, okay. Well, it's actually, I don't know how much of a fair question that is, because, you know, that if anyone had the opportunity to actually have sort of nearly 60 years of experience, and okay, most of that was spent in nappies. It wasn't. The first few years, most of that was...
Was it spent in Ibiza, was it, mate?
So, no, exactly. No, not all of it was spent sort of actively, gainfully employed or in, you know, productively investing.
Yeah.
So, you know, you do that whole time is a learning process.
Exactly.
And I think that the... probably the most important thing you have to do is you have to lose your ego. You have to, and that takes years to actually understand that there's two different parts of you, of the mind, and the ego is something that can really. Ego looks for immediate gratification.
Yes,
it wants that feeling. You know, everything we do in life is to get a feeling. You can break it down whichever way you like. I mean, you say you want money. Well, why do you want money? Well, because you can do this, that, and the other. Why do you want to do this and the other? Ultimately, it's because it makes you feel good.
Yes.
Why don't you want to lose money? Yeah. It's because it makes you feel bad. Yeah. And why does it make you feel bad? Well, because you're not going to be able to do this, the things that make you feel good. Yeah. So the ego is going to lead you into all sorts of trouble. And the ego finds its way in sort of out there if there's an opportunity for him to for it to take over and just basically celebrate or yeah. Or you know, lead you off course for immediate gratification.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I would say now, if I could have approached, and there are a lot of mature people who are young who've actually learned that lesson. It just took me a lot longer. And if you can actually sort of put aside your need to be right, which is the other thing about the ego, mm. and just accept the fact that, you know, you are entering into this trade or you're looking at this trade, you've got to feel a bit scared in doing it. If you feel it's a winner, a banker, nothing can go wrong, that's the time something is going to go wrong. So yeah. you've got to feel that fear when you actually are making the investment yeah. and recognize that it's not, whatever it is, it's not set in stone that you actually are going to make a multi-bagger out of this. So, yeah, I would approach my investments in a more patient way. I would not just jump at the opportunity of building a position. I'd be ready to pounce. I'd be ready sitting there waiting mm-hmm. And also not suffer too much from this fear of missing out, which is drives a lot of people in the market yes, where they're yes. looking at a stock. It's running. They've been watching and watching and watching and they've done nothing. Now it starts to move and they jump on, you know. I mean, that's it works if there's momentum. And you can play the momentum, but at the moment, you know, this market, there's not much momentum that you can actually bank on. So I think, you know, if that's a long-winded way of answering, but I think, you know, if sum it up, is just learn more patience and also not to, you know, to keep a firm control and handle on the ego.
No, I think you've absolutely nailed it there. And you touched on some of the stuff that you've learnt there, Malcolm. And there's a famous quote by George Satanyana, the American philosopher and poet. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
Yeah.
Does that resonate?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, you know, you've got to be able to learn from your mistakes. As I said, you know, market's only here for two things: make your money and teach your lessons.
Exactly. Exactly. We've covered all, Malcolm. It's been absolutely fantastic having you on Conquest Corner, mate. You've been an absolute revelation. Now, I'm conscious I'm keeping you. I've covered all my questions. Is there anything you want to share beyond what we've covered already, or to just get off your chest regarding investing, the landscape, anything else?
Okay, well, people who know me know that, you know, I can talk forever, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. I kind of think that we've covered pretty much most of what I wanted to say. I did make some notes.
Okay.
That I'm just going to sort of run through. Okay. Yeah, here's an important one. It says the financial markets don't do win-win. In business, I always try to do win-win, which means that basically, you know, I'm looking to do business with people who, where we both benefit, you know. Yeah, I'm not trying to get the upper hand or not trying to allowing other people to get the upper hand. The markets are a zero sum game, which is like any other. This is why I sort of refer to them in not a derogatory way as being like casinos.
Yeah,
because, you know, you're going into a poker game. You've got to understand that you're playing against the house and you're also playing against your fellow investors.
Yes.
Because we're all on the same side when we're investing in the same stock. But when we're selling, we're in competition with each other.
Of course, yeah.
And we're also in competition when we're buying because we're between us perhaps forcing the price up.
Indeed, yeah.
So, you know, recognize that. Just understand that, you know, whilst, you know, you have this camaraderie and that's good, but everyone has to look after their own you know, their own position.
Yes.
Have to, you know, if I start, I need to ask you if I need to sell, should I be selling this now? That's the wrong question to ask a competitor.
Because everyone's got their own strategy. Everyone's got the different risk levels. Everyone's coming at different times as well to the price. as well. And everybody's got a different exit strategy as well. So, yeah,
exactly. Indeed. And you need that. You can't rely on other people to tell you that. You've got to earn it. If you make 10% out of a stock and someone else makes 300%, you should be happy. You've made 10%. Greed doesn't work in that way.
No.
You know. They had a higher risk tolerance. They rode it a bit farther. They could have lost more.
Yes, they did.
You know, that's it. So that was, I think, pretty much. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Look, thank you, Peter. If there's anything else you want to ask me, by all means, do so. But I'm very happy with this, and I'm very happy to talk to you about this. I think it's a great thing you're doing here.
Thank you very much.
I love what all the guys at LSE Share Talk are doing as well. So, best of luck with your stuff as well.
No, thank you very much, mate. Malcolm, it's been fantastic having you on. I hope when Consilium and Satoshi do the next deals, we can probably get you back on. You can tell me what's going on there. But I'd love to have you probably on talking about Bitcoin as a separate issue maybe at some stage in the future.
Very happy to do that. I certainly keep my eye on what they're doing at Coincilium.
Yeah.
I hear the news in the same way as everyone else hears the news, but I sort of perhaps I've got a bit of a sixth sense because I see what's going on in the space. But
yes.
I would say that, you know, there will be some stuff happening there. And if anyone wants to understand a little bit more about Bitcoin and blockchain, I'm putting together at the moment with a guy in Birmingham, a meetup group, it was going to be called Barbarian Thinking, which was my idea, because I like this idea, a concept of thinking like a barbarian, as in outside of the box. And, we're calling it Blockchain Thinking.
Right.
It's running in Birmingham. We're probably going to be looking at doing some in London, but there are lots of groups which are focusing on this now. So, if anyone wants to know anything more about blockchain or this area, then drop me an email and be very happy to pass on details and information and perhaps point them in the right direction.
No, that's very kind of you. Malcolm, I do a lot of tweets on fintech and blockchain, so if you send me a DM or if you tweet it to me, I'll make sure I retweet it and put it out there for everybody as well.
Right. Okay. Well, happy to catch up with you in that regard as well, and put you in touch with the company if you feel that there's anything you want to talk to them about.
Okie dokie. Excellent. Love that. I'm happy to speak with the rest of the team at Consilium as well and get them on Conquer's Corner to talk about their investing journey as well, Malcolm.
Okay. Well, okay. I'll certainly pass that message on.
All right. Malcolm, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Enjoy the rest of your day. And
thank
I look forward
and
to speaking to you again soon.
Okay. Cheers.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Right. Is that it?
That's it, mate. Yeah.
Okay. Right.